I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Black African immigrants are the fastest growing immigrant population in the United States. Since its inception in the 1990s, nearly half of the beneficiaries of the so-called green card lottery are from Africa and the Caribbean. But black immigrants also have higher rates of unemployment and deportation than any other group. Today, a conversation about the particular challenges facing black immigrants. I'm joined by Amaha Kasa, a community organizer and founder of African Communities Together, Nana Brantuo, she's a researcher with Black Africans for Just Immigration, Jonathan Jace Green is with the Baltimore-based UndocuBlack Network, and Towson University dreamer and organizer Fatima Zahra Berry. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us today for Midday. Donald Trump announced his candidacy for the presidency in the summer of 2015 with a vow to get tough on undocumented immigrants. In September, Trump made good on his promise to end DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program. But soon thereafter, he purportedly struck a deal with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to protect DACA beneficiaries permanently. Congress has until March to act on legislation. On the first of this month, the president announced that he would recommend to Congress that it discontinue the diversity visa program, known as the Green Card Lottery, in the wake of an attack by an Uzbek man who killed 8 pedestrians in New York City. Today, we're going to focus on a particular group of immigrants who are affected by immigration policy in ways unlike any other group. Black African immigrants are the fastest growing immigrant population in the United States. According to Pew Research, there was a 153% surge in the black African immigrant population between 2000 and 2014. 10% of all blacks living in the United States are foreign-born. That's up from 3% back in the 1980s. They are a population that is often highly educated, family-oriented, and hardworking. These, of course, are all virtues that form the cornerstone of the American value system. So why do these black immigrants face the highest levels of deportation and unemployment? Coming up later, we'll talk to two dreamers who are activists and organizers of undocumented black African immigrants. But first, I'm joined by Amaha Kasa. He's the founder and executive director of African Communities Together. Amaha is an immigrant from Ethiopia, and he joins us on the phone from New York City. Mr. Kasa, welcome.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
Nana Brantuo is a doctoral candidate in minority and urban education at the University of Maryland College Park and a policy manager with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Ms. Brantuo, welcome as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mr. Kasa, when we talk about black immigrants, where do the majority come from?
Well, there are almost 2 million immigrants from Africa in the U.S., and as you noted earlier, that number has increased exponentially. It's almost doubled in each of the last decade. In terms of Africans in the U.S., the biggest sending countries include Nigeria, Ethiopia, which is where I'm from, Ghana, Liberia, Kenya, South Africa, and that's particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. And then obviously there's while the growth in the African immigrant communities is more recent, for over a century, there's been significant migration from the Caribbean, and so both from countries like Haiti and then the English-speaking West Indian countries. I think Nana could also add to some of the African populations are coming from.
And Nana Brantuo, is there a particular reason, that the immigrant population from these countries has increased so dramatically over the past several years?
Well, I think definitely we have to pay attention to just overall the 1990 Immigration Act, in which you see the diversity visa, which greatly benefits African and Caribbean migrants, in particular African migrants coming from sub-Saharan Africa. So we see a large growth in terms of people being able to migrate as policies have changed and shifted. But with those shifts and changes, we also have a lot of policy that was introduced that negatively impact Black immigrant communities, in particular 1996 immigration laws, which really increases the rate in which folks are made detainable and deportable. But definitely, the 1990 Act opens up diversity visa, also introduces temporary protected status, which allows for folks who are unauthorized living in the United States to stay in the country as their countries are dealing with conflict, different epidemics, ongoing, also natural disaster, and so on and so forth.
What happened in 1996? What sorts of changes made people, as you say, more deportable, more detainable?
Well, in 1996 is during the Clinton administration, we have the IRA-IRA, which is an act which basically, along with, there was mainly IRA-IRA, but there are a lot of acts that come through the Clinton administration, which vow to just make it so that we are prioritizing quote-unquote legal immigration and those folks who are living undocumented in the United States, dependent upon any crimes they commit, in particular felony crimes. And felonies are very range in definition in terms, depending on where folks live, are able to be detained and deported at a much faster rate as was prior to. Mm-hmm. So during that administration, and with that, we continue to see the repercussions of how Black immigrants in particular are impacted, because Black immigrants tend to live alongside African Americans, typically in urban areas that are often over surveilled and over policed. And also, we are very clear that there are definite stereotypes and an overall criminalization of Black people, regardless of their nation of origin, living in the United States. So it's a creation of problematic policy along with problematic procedures and protocol from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, but also from police at local and state levels that end up negatively impacting Black immigrant communities.
And in a little bit, we'll talk more about criminalization, deportation, those dimensions of this problem. But Amha Kasa, talk about this diversity visa program. This is something that the president made big truck about a few weeks ago after the apparent terrorist incident in New York. It was actually begun in the 1990s by Senator Ted Kennedy, and it was directed towards Irish nationals who were figuring out a way of staying in the country. But why is it that Black immigrants constitute about 50% of the people who get these permissions through what's commonly known as the green card lottery?
I think to understand the diversity visa, you have to understand what it means to be able to enter this country legally. There are very few paths, and often those paths are very narrow and long to enter the U.S. Legally. And one of the primary ones is through family. That's how the majority of immigrants to the U.S. come, is through family reunification. But what if you don't have family here to apply for you? It means that there's essentially no path to come here. So the diversity visa was instituted by Ted Kennedy. Chuck Schumer from New York was another major architect of the program, and said, well, there are certain countries that have historically sent lower levels, or in recent history sent lower levels of immigration, including Ireland, Poland, and Africa, the entire continent. And so we're going to create this lottery, which allows people an opportunity to apply for admission, which is very important for people to understand. It's not, you enter a lottery and you get a plane ticket and a green card. You enter a lottery and you win the opportunity to apply. There's extensive screening, biometrics, and a process that can take over a year, 1 to 2 years to complete before you finally are allowed admission. And as you say, the number has fluctuated year to year, but between 40 and 50% of people coming through that program come from the African continent. And there are requirements. You have to have a minimum of high school education, but because it's a difficult program to navigate, it requires internet access, it requires ability to read documents in English, Most of the people have well above a high school education. They often have a college degree or a graduate degree. So this program has been in place, as Nana said, for you know, almost 30 years, 27 years, admitting, you know, 40 to 50,000 people per year. So we've seen over a million people admitted through this program. And we have one instance this year of, you know, a bad actor coming in through the program, you know, who initially entered to the program, through all reports, you know, was radicalized domestically and wasn't connected to any larger community. And as a result of that, you know, the President Trump and some of the hard right xenophobic faction in the party has called for ending this program. And, you know, it's literally a one in a million occurrence. So we should be making policy based on the million, not based on this one exceptional instance.
And Mr. Casa, tell us the difference between this program, the diversity visa program, and, for example, the H-1B skilled worker visa. Are they related in any way?
They're related in that you know, they tend to attract you know, people with higher skills. But H-1B program is really tethered to an employer, and so it's expensive for one thing. You know, an employer needs to sponsor an employee. There's a limited number of visas that go out, and you are essentially tied to an employer when you come here. Whereas the diversity visa is just saying, listen, we're going to give, you know, the vast majority of countries of the world an opportunity to emigrate, you know, to migrate to the U.S. legally. And so in many parts of the world where you don't get refugee resettlement or where you don't see, you know, big family, you know, large family reunification coming to the U.S., it's one of the only pathways. So how are you going to be sort of hired or recruited by a U.S.-based employer if you're abroad? You know, only if you're already in a very sort of elite stratum of skilled professionals are you likely to have that opportunity. This is a little bit more democratic.
And Nana Brantu, the temporary protected status, which is granted to various people because they may be leaving places that have heavily armed conflicts going on or a natural disaster, how does this play into the Black immigrant experience? Are there a number of people in that population who are protected under TPS?
Yes. So actually, we have folks, nationals that are coming who are from Haiti, Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan, and formerly Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. But TPS status for those nationals was terminated earlier this year. But we have a large number of African and Caribbean from Haiti migrants who are impacted by TPS. And in terms of having the conversation, there's been ongoing conversation amongst advocates, but also out in Capitol Hill, of ensuring that this administration makes sure that TPS is solidified and remains a part of immigration policy in the United States, because we have like close to 60,000 Haitian immigrants who are living in the United States, who establish communities here, who also contribute to their families back home through remittances, who are unable to return to Haiti at this moment because there has been epidemic. There has been several hurricanes. There was a major earthquake, and there are ways in which the government is trying its best to make sure that when folks are repatriated, they're able to enter into society without fears of any relapses in epidemic, without any issues in terms of social, physical, and economic infrastructure. But we have a large number of folks who are impacted by this. About 13 to 14% of TPS recipients come from sub-Saharan Africa or the Caribbean.
And Amha Kasa, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration has a set of recommendations in a report that they released recently. And this is the work, as you know, that Nana Brantuo has been doing for quite a while. One of those recommendations is to remove convictions as a ground for deportation or exclusion, including convictions for things like aggravated felonies and drug offenses. Obviously, Mr. Trump was elected in some measure, perhaps in large measure, because of his very advocacy for doing that very thing. That strikes me that might be a very difficult thing to sell. How do you feel about that particular recommendation, and what's the argument for it?
Mm-hmm. Well, we think it's important to have a more rational and balanced immigration system. Unfortunately, our immigration system and the diversity visa, this recent move to eliminate the diversity visa as an example, tends to be sort of headline driven. It tends to be, sort of in reaction to the latest scandal or whichever group is making the most noise. And you know, in terms of what the things that we would want an immigration system to do, to be humane, to be fair, and to offer people an opportunity to get ahead and to offer the U.S. the opportunity to benefit from their experience. Unfortunately, our immigration system is not very good at doing any of those things right now. The sensationalism around immigrants and crime, the reality is that, crime committed by immigrants immigrants commit crimes at much lower rates than native-born Americans. Most people are just here trying to make a living and trying to get by in their daily lives. Now, it is true that especially crimes related to poverty, jumping the turnstile in the subway or the metro, peddling on the street without a license, those crimes may be more likely to be committed by low-income immigrants, and because of the reality of racial profiling, it may be more likely that black immigrants in particular are the reality that black immigrants in particular are picked up for those crimes. So we think that we should have an immigration system that's less about being punitive and is more about being restorative. So we support, taking a close look at policies that put people in essentially in double jeopardy, once in, criminally and once in terms of banishment and removal from the U.S. I mean, we have seen cases where, people are picked up for relatively minor crimes. They've lived in the U.S. their entire lives, and they find themselves facing removal to a country that they've never been to. So we do think that we need to rationalize the immigration system a little more.
And Ms. Casa, before we need to let you go this afternoon, you're absolutely right. The data is very clear about the fact that immigrants commit far fewer crimes than native-born Americans. But when the immigration system identifies a person who's committed, an aggravated felony, a real felony, what Mr. Trump might refer to as one of those bad hombres. Should that be grounds for deportation and detention? Where does one draw the line if someone is here on a green card lottery program or even here in some undocumented way, if he or she is identified as a felon, is that grounds for taking some sort of immigration action?
Look, there are going to be cases where someone is going to be subject to deportation because of actions they've taken. I mean, for example, we've seen cases even with, where people were former torturers in their country of origin and they committed human rights violations. And those folks misrepresented, why they were here and how they were here. And we support removal in some cases. I guess what we're saying is that it's gone so overboard in targeting specific communities. And, the reality, again, is that sometimes these laws are only enforced against specific communities and that certain communities are much less likely to have due process. So are there some cases where someone should face removal and deportation because of criminal acts that they've taken? Absolutely, that's going to happen. But what we're saying is that right now we have a system that's way out of whack.
Amaha Kasa is the founder and executive director of African Communities Together. He's joined us from New York. Mr. Kasa, I really appreciate your insight and your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nana Brantuo is policy manager with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She'll be with us when we come back on the other side of a quick break. And we'll also meet two dreamers who are organizing fellow black immigrants. You can join our conversation here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. We're glad you're with us. Stick around. And good afternoon. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we get back to our conversation about Black immigrants, I want to pass along an email from a listener yesterday. Cynthia wrote us. We're talking about caring for older adults, for family members, for family friends. And she recommends a group called Partners on the Path. So if you go to partnersonthepath.org, that is a resource for various ideas and techniques that you might want to employ if you are one of those folks providing care for a loved one. By the way, coming up tomorrow here on our program, Free Speech on College Campuses, our efforts to provide trigger warnings and create safe spaces in higher education, leading to a disregard for free speech rights that are enshrined in the First Amendment. Eugene Volokh is a law professor at the UCLA School of Law. Sigal Ben-Porath is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of a book called Free Speech on Campus. So are students willing to forego free speech protections in favor of quashing ideas with which they may not agree? So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about immigration and the particular challenges faced by immigrants of color. Nana Brantuo is a doctoral candidate in minority and urban education at the University of Maryland College Park and a policy manager with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. She joins us from NPR in D.C., and I'm happy to welcome to the program two Dreamers, undocumented immigrants who are also activists and organizers who are working with those directly affected by programs like DACA and the Green Card Lottery. Jonathan Jace Green is a queer, undocumented Afro-Panamanian and one of the co-founders of the UndocuBlack Network. He holds a degree from Goucher College. He has served as liaison and advocate of the Latinx and Caribbean communities in the Office of the Governor during the O'Malley administration. He also joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Jonathan Jace Green, welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
And Fatima Zahra Berry is a junior at Towson University and the founder of TU Dreamers. That's a group of undocumented DACA refugee and immigrant students. She is originally from Chad. She is a member of Towson's Honors College, a resident assistant, an RA, a senator in the Student Government Association, and a tutor at Towson's Writing Center. Fatima Zahra Berry, you're a very busy young woman, so I'm very delighted and grateful for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
So, Fatima, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your story, how you ended up here in the country. You're from Chad originally. How did you come to the U.S.?
Well, my dad, he was a diplomat, a Chadian diplomat, and he came here right before I was born. And he moved my mom and I here to America when I was around two, a toddler, and we lived around in PG County in Adelphi, which is only 45 minutes away from here. Mm-hmm. And again, I was young. I didn't know about my status until his visa expired in 2005, which ultimately my visa expired as well.
And then, so where were you physically born? Were you physically born
in Chad?
In Chad. Mm-hmm. And then so you came just as a very young child.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
2 years old.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And you discovered that as a senior in high school. All of a sudden your folks finally let the cat out of the bag and say, oh, by the way, you're undocumented, and so are we. Mm-hmm. Are your folks still here in the States with you?
Yes.
Yeah. And so what happened then?
Well, senior year, you know, applying to college, and then I had to apply for FAFSA. Unfortunately, you need a green card or some sort of proof that you are a citizen here. And when I asked my mom for my Social Security number, that's when I found out, oh, I'm not a U.S. citizen.
And FAFSA is the form you fill out for financial aid and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, correct. So upon learning this, my dad, we both applied for DACA. And luckily, I was granted and I received it. And senior year, I worked saving money for college. And I received my Social Security number and my driver's license. So everything was smooth sail.
Yeah. Until recently.
Until recently, yes.
Yeah. So what's your next move then, given that the president has decided to end this program? Congress has until March to come up with a permanent solution. Between now and then, what's your play here?
Well, on campus, I'm the president of TU Dreamers, and the club is mainly for creating a safe space for undocumented and those who identify as immigrants on campus. And my main objective right now is just making sure everyone's fine and know about the program and outreaching it towards people who don't identify as the Latinx community, because oftentimes undocumented kind of mix up with the Latinx community and people forget that African descent or those from the Caribbeans or from the Middle East or Asia, they're often left out of the narrative. So I want to incorporate them into the conversation. And also, I'm very, very huge on mental health. So making sure that everyone's mentality is where it should be. This is a sensitive issue. We're dealing with families, we're dealing with kids, we're dealing with a whole bunch of different identities. So making sure that everyone is as calm as they can be during this time of crisis.
Fatima Zahra Berry, she's a junior at Towson University and the founder of a group there called TU Dreamers. Jonathan J. Screen, tell us a little bit about your organization. You co-founded it. It's called the UndocuBlack Network.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. So the UndocuBlack Network is a multi-generational network of undocumented Black people organizing our own communities and building power. We actually arose actually out of the uprisings in Baltimore when I was a part of the protest and really grieving the death of Freddie Gray and really realizing the broader injustice that happens with Black people in this country, and realizing that folks didn't see those people at those intersections. People didn't see why someone like me was really worried about being deported and also trying to get to school, but also being alive, given that I live in the city of Baltimore, right? So we created this organization just to be able to have a space for our people, for our undocumented Black people across the country to feel seen, heard, loved, right? According to Baji's report, there's close to 600,000 Black undocumented people. I'm talking about African, Caribbean, and also Afro-Latinx people like me, right? Because we can't forget that Black people also are Latinx, right? So there's close to 600,000 Black undocumented people in this country that, according to Baji's report, really experienced this system and this world in a unique way due to anti-Blackness, right? So how do we create a space for our folks to be able to process what's going on, connect our people to resources, but then also really empower our own selves to fight back?
So, and when you speak of the Baji report, you're talking about the BAGI report, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, and that's a report that Nana Brantuo knows quite well. Nana, the parallels between the Black immigrant experience and the experience of Black Americans, there are some, to be sure, several perhaps, but there are also different challenges. Outline what some of those are from the immigrant perspective as opposed to the native-born perspective for Black folks in our country.
Well, I would definitely say so. Obviously, in particular for our undocumented folks, the real fear of detention and deportation is one of the things that's strikingly different in terms of experience. But embedded within that is still the criminalization that Black people who are U.S. citizens or U.S. born, along with Black immigrants, always face. And I think when speaking about both Black immigrant and African American experiences, it's just hard to divorce the two because there's so many ways in which things are greatly embedded. Largely, when folks talk about, and there have been a string of reports that talk about Black immigrants, in particular African immigrants, being highly educated, right? With about 25-27% of all Black immigrants that come into the nation over the age of 25 having a bachelor's degree. And that's in the mid-30 percentage for African immigrants in particular. But in that discussion, there's often there's a lack of conversation around how that educational attainment does not translate into wealth, does not translate into owning property, things like that. And that's largely because of the legacy of anti-Blackness within U.S. policy, whether it's housing, whether it's education. I'm coming from the D.C. area. There are plenty of African and Caribbean cab drivers that you'll meet that come from their nations with bachelor's and master's, some PhD degrees, and a lot of them are driving cabs. And a lot of that has to do, too, with how our educational systems in terms of the credentials that come out of those spaces from the Caribbean and Africa are often undervalued, which is similar to the African-American experience as well. There are ways in which people will view credentials coming from a historically Black college or university as lower than from a predominantly white institution as well. So there are ways in which our experiences greatly mirror each other. Even when we talk about, if we're talking about poverty, for instance, 1 in 5 Black immigrants lives at or below the poverty line, which is major in terms of conversation. And it really maps onto to African-American issues as well, especially when we're talking about urban living. We live in the same spaces. We deal with the same sort of policing, same surveillance. If we're in under-resourced areas, we also are, like our counterparts, like our siblings of African-American community, we are under-resourced as well. And that translates into educational pursuits as well. And there are ways in which I want to make sure when we do use statistics and we do talk about these things, we also make sure to ground that in the reality of, yes, we're highly educated, but we're also, in terms of unemployment rates, the highest of immigrant groups. When we talk about median income, we are below that of American citizens and all immigrant groups as well. So making sure to continually address that something is happening here, and the thing that is happening is this anti-Blackness that has been embedded within the United States policy structures.
I want to dig down a little deeper in that in a minute, but first let me turn back to Fatima. You are a DACA recipient, and that actually represents a relatively small percentage of the people who are protected under that program. As you mentioned, people think of DACA as being largely for, you know, Mexicans and people of Hispanic origin. It covers about 3% of people whose native countries are in Africa. What's the consequence of that for you as a DACA recipient who doesn't happen to be Hispanic?
Definitely the lack of representation. It's very hard to get your voice out there if people don't know that you're part of the movement. So that's definitely a big downfall. And also, you don't know who to go to, because when you feel invisible, you don't know, can I reach out to my fellow Black Africans or my fellow Latinx members? And there's a division between us, and I believe that division shouldn't be there in the first place.
And Jonathan J. Screen, it's interesting that you started your network, the Undocu Black Network, because of a response to the murder of Freddie Gray in the hands of police and the unrest that followed after that back in 2015. So in terms of this kinship and the commonality between your experience as an Afro-Panamanian person as opposed to an African-American person, is the divide, do you think of the divide as being pretty vast, or do you think of it as being subtle?
Well, I think with anything, with any issue, there's always going to be some nuances and divides here and there. But for me, I really embraced and owned the fact that even though I'm undocumented, and yes, we're fighting to pass a Clean Dream Act, yes, we're fighting to pass some permanent solution for TPS, temporary protective status holders, right? Like, it being Black in this fight gives me clarity about who the culprit is, right? We're not just talking about anti-immigrant sentiments in this country. We're really talking about a broader system of white supremacy, right, that is rooted in viewing our people as disposable, right? Because I know that at the end of the day, when we pass some immigration solutions, I'm still not going to be free, right? Frederick Gray was a U.S. citizen. Sandra Brown was a U.S. citizen. That didn't keep them alive, right? So I think that that's really where I like to focus my attention on, is like, what is a greater fight? What is a greater enemy that we're all fighting against? And how do we unite around that cause?
And Nana Brantuo, we're going to take a break in just a bit. But before we do, I want to talk about the criminal convictions and detentions and how that plays into this narrative and this story. The scope of the problem is huge. The numbers of Black immigrants who are convicted and removed, I mean, in the general immigrant population, 3.5 times in that population, they are likely to be removed for immigration violations, whereas people from the Caribbean are twice as likely to be detained for a criminal violation. Half of all Black immigrants facing removal are facing it because of criminal grounds. This comes from your report. So how do you respond to the person who's going to say, well, rather than this being a statistic that shows injustice and systemic inequality in the immigration system, certainly a systemic inequality that we've all identified in many other systems in our country, rather than being a statistic about injustice, it's simply a statistic that demonstrates an inclination towards criminality.
Absolutely not. that's fascinating. Yeah,
so that you pose that. So make that argument, because there are people listening who are thinking just that right now.
Oh, 100%. I'm definitely coming to that. So I just want us to. This happens in a lot of different spaces, right? Especially when we talk about Black people, and I think in making that assertion or that assumption, we need to first step back a bit. And definitely take a look at the history of the United States and how Black people in particular have been treated, especially when we talk about criminalization. For those who are familiar, Ava DuVernay did an excellent documentary, 13th, which takes a look at the 13th Amendment and how in which it wasn't necessarily a means of freeing the larger Black population, because if that was so, we wouldn't then have convict leasing, we wouldn't now have this larger prison industrial complex that feeds into mass criminalization that also feeds into mass deportation. The fact of the matter is we have to look at the whole of U.S. history and the ways in which Black people have been treated in this country. We are inherently viewed as criminal on the basis of stereotypes that happened long ago following slavery, especially with the coming of the motion picture. The portrayal of Black people, of Black bodies, of Black thoughts is inherently criminal or dangerous to white bodies, white thoughts, white supremacy in general. It's definitely when I met with this assumption, to me, there's a lack of willingness to really dig deeply into what does the United States stand for? How has the United States treated Black people? And we definitely have to have that conversation, especially if we just look at larger policy. The facts are, it's on the books. You know, we were property. Black people were property in this nation for a very long time. We can't divorce that from the larger conversation then of how Black bodies and brown bodies, too, are continually fed into prison systems, which benefit from that labor of Black bodies in those spaces. We can't divorce that from conversations around the immigrant detention centers, which are more or less just prisons for people of color, in particular Black and brown bodies, in the ways in which they benefit from the contracts that they have.
Yeah,
I definitely not at all.
I couldn't agree with you more about the history and the rates of incarceration as being something that, you know, has to be considered and understood in a very specific way. But is there any data to suggest that the people who are being deported on criminal grounds, rather than because they've broken some immigration law, but rather that they have committed some sort of crime, that those crimes are, the charges are being trumped up, that the charges aren't true, that people are being unjustly incarcerated for crimes they didn't commit?
It's interesting that you bring up the data point, because we also have to pay attention in terms of how things are funded and how people do pursue or focus on research. Largely, perspectives of Black people and people of color are excluded. So we find a lot of different scholars in the different universities in particular that are taking on this task of making sure that we're using the data to tell a larger story of injustice. But there's largely been an overall aversion in talking about the ways in which people have viewed their convictions, in which this is something that's systematic. And I mean, it's very fascinating when you're a person that lives on the margins, because you can give as much qualitative data and much qualitative share stories. You can do all of that. And people rarely listen or rarely believe you. Black people have been talking about police brutality for a very long time. And it's only until now that we see that there are cameras now that are capturing what's happening, right? Started with Rodney King, and now it's something that's almost regular, that now people are listening and hearing. So I think it's important when we're talking about the collection of data, which is important because the data is out there and there are people that are doing that work and unearthing that, yes, there are trends. I mean, even the FBI, in terms of work that they've done, they recently released the 2016 overview of hate crimes, and especially those racial incidents that were, or those bias incidents that were based on race were largely over 50% anti-Black based, right? So it's important to delve into the data, but it's also important to make sure that we're listening to what folks are talking about, in particular when we're taking into account the spaces that they're coming from.
Nana Brantuo is a doctoral candidate in minority and urban education at the University of Maryland College Park. She's also a policy manager with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Fatima Zahra Berry is a junior at Towson University and the founder of TU Dreamers. Jonathan Jace Green is a co-founder of the UndocuBlack Network. We'll have more on the particular challenges faced by immigrants from Africa, the Caribbean, and elsewhere when we come back from a break. If you'd like to join our conversation, again, our phone number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about immigration challenges faced by people of color. Black immigrants are more likely to be deported or arrested than any other group. Despite high levels of education, they have the highest rates of unemployment. There are approximately 5 million foreign-born Black people living in the United States. Perhaps as many as 3.7 million of them are non-citizens. Many entered the U.S. through the Diversity Visa Program, a program that President Trump has vowed to end following the most recent attack in New York. My guest today, Nana Brantuo. She's a doctoral candidate in minority and urban education at the University of Maryland and a policy manager with the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Fatima Zahra Berry is a junior at Towson University. She founded a group called the TU Dreamers. And Jonathan Jace Green, he's a co-founder of the UndocuBlack Network. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email midday@wypr.org. So Fatima, just yesterday, according to Reuters, a U.S. appeals court in California let President Trump's travel ban go partially into effect, barring people from six Muslim-majority countries unless they have some connection to the United States. This was in the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. How does that affect your family from Chad?
Well, since my country of origin is Chad, and that's on their new revised travel ban, unfortunately, we cannot go in and out of the country. And for me specifically, being an international studies major, I thought going into college, I'll do study abroad, experience the world outside of America. But that changed my plan, so no more study abroad. And it is devastating to know that I can't go back home and visit family, my grandparents, my cousins who are still in Chad. And I can only imagine how my parents are taking it because they do have relatives back in Chad as well.
Of course. And when was the last time you were in Chad? You yourself?
It will be probably 14 years.
Yeah. Long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tough. And Jonathan J. Screen, what are the priorities for your group, the UndocuBlack Network? What's the top of your list?
Yeah, so the top two things we're fighting for in terms of policy, if that's what you're particularly referring to, are, you know, people have talked about the DREAM Act being the legislative solution to fix and protect close to over a million undocumented young people that are in this country that are losing their DACA status, people like myself and Fatima. So the DREAM Act would be a fix for that. But what we're particularly focusing on is making sure that as negotiations are happening on the DREAM Act, that we're not adding any criminalization or border and immigration enforcement to that bill. We know that there are people salivating across this country at this opportunity to continue to expand on the deportability of our people, to continue to expand in some of the ways that Nana shared about how our folks are particularly impacted in terms of criminalization, right? So we know as Black undocumented people and Black people in general, we cannot allow or cannot support bills that continue to expand on the attacks of our people. So that's our priority for the DREAM Act. And still fighting for TPS, because like Nana shared, there are several Black majority countries that have it, and TPS is not getting as much attention in the national dialogue.
Yeah, that's temporary protected status, right?
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. So we're fighting for those two policy priorities. But, you know, something that Fatima said earlier on that really resonated with me and really resonates with the work that we do at UndocuBlack, we've actually recently launched a mental wellness initiative because we are really prioritizing the well-being of our people. Right. We know that in what's happening, right, that our communities are being under attack each and every day, that all these policies are being talked about, right? But what does it mean to be undocumented in today's society? We know that that means trauma. But we also know that being Black in this country has been trauma since this country's founding. So what does it mean to be at that intersection without having access to healthcare or health, mental wellness resources? So we are hoping to bridge that. So we launched a guide that is published on our website, undocublack.org, and continuing to expand upon resources that are available for our people, because we know that we can't have organizing, we can't have policy change if our people, at the end of the day, are not well.
Yeah, the emotional toll on you, Fatima, and on you, Jonathan, you know, because you don't have access to a lot of the resources that other native-born people would have. It's difficult to imagine. Let's see if we can sneak in one phone call here. Yvonne in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air.
Okay. I think I hear the justifiable anger coming from Jonathan regarding race relations in the United States. But I would like to ask him about the division between Africans from the continent and African Americans. I know that it exists. I'm a nurse. I work with a lot of Africans. I hear it all the time from both sides. They do not get along. One group is feels superior to the other. And I want to know if Jonathan feels that his group is adding to the trauma that all Black people experience.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. So we did talk about that earlier in the show a little bit. But, Jonathan, your reaction between this perception on the part of some people that there is this great divide between Africans and African Americans.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Yvonne, for asking that question. As I think about the work that we're doing, that we're continuing to build with UndocuBlack, I don't know that folks really understand that it really is about a love letter to our people, that we're daring to create space for folks to be able to process what's happening, to be able to have space and build community and find ways to fight back for a more just world, right? So it's less about those divisions, less about really feeding into how communities and how systems of oppression have, you know, impacted how we see each other, right? So, because that's real. But for us, it's about how do we create a loving space for our people to be able to thrive, right? At the end of the day, we talk about all these great principles that our country, the United States of America, is supposed to stand for, and then we see that they don't apply across the board, right? So how do we have a fight, right, to be able to have this country live up to the ideals that we say that we hold, right? So I think that's a larger conversation for us at UndocuBlack. It's a space for Black undocumented people that haven't had that space, that haven't had a space to be able to connect to resources and fight back. So it really isn't about the divisions at all.
And Nana Brantua, let me give you the last word. We just got a little bit of time left here. There's, a lot of evidence, and the historical record is pretty clear that there is a lot of systemic racism in the immigration policy of the United States. I mean, it goes back to Chinese immigrants and how they were treated during the 1800s, or Eastern European Jews who came into the country, you know, or Japanese Americans during the Second World War. But Republican opponents of this green card lottery, the people who support the president's decision to get rid of it, say that it excludes all these people from coming into the country, because if you've got to come from a country that has more than 50,000 immigrants, you're not allowed to apply under the green card lottery. And they would prefer that these visas go to, you know, STEM people, Europeans, Asians who know about all of this STEM stuff. How do you respond to that?
I mean, my general response in terms of the, because this is not the first time where people have attempted to cut the diversity visa lottery. This is not the first time, and this is something that happens from Congress to Congress, from Republicans. And I think it is largely a conversation around the fear of, or just the overall anger of accepting more people of color into this nation.
Okay.
Because this visa impacts all types of people of color, not just Africans, but people from Nepal, from Uzbekistan, different places where are identified by Republicans as threats.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. I'm very grateful to all of you, Nana Brantua, Fatima Zahri-Berry, and Jonathan J. Screen. Thank you all so much. Appreciate it very much. Tomorrow we're going to talk about free speech on college campuses with Eugene Voloff and Sigal Ben-Parath from the University of Pennsylvania. Today we want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. They serve cold-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Their locations and hours are at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of our entire midday team, we appreciate your listening. Have a great day.